Hello, and welcome to another episode of Robbinsdale Revisited. 'Twas September the 5th, and through the new school, not a thing was broken, not even a rule. The books were stacked in the cupboards with care, knowing that students soon would be there. The new high school opened in 1957. Six Robbinsdale congregations built new buildings in the 1950s. Robin Center opened in 1955. Local children enjoyed a Christmas tree bonfire in 1956, and in school they focused on math and science due to the space race. The League of Women Voters was established in 1957. Now, Pete Ritchie, president of the Robbinsdale Historical Society, will tell us more about the 1950s.
The new high school is down there at 36th Avenue and really close to Highway 100 on Toledo. Again, we're just going to read from our high school friends and their old yearbook. So in 1957, they describe it this way. Our school will continue to grow and grow and grow. Its teachers will educate more students and prepare more able citizens for our society. Our building is young. It is itself new. And in it, new traditions will be established. The life of our new Robbinsdale High School has just begun, and its future is yet to come. Everybody was excited for this new high school. It was huge. You know, I was going to Armstrong in the 1980s, and we had about the same number of students. I graduated with like 700 students, and I think that's what was happening throughout most of the 1950s at Robbinsdale High School. Of course, by the 1960s, it's time to build another school. It was mentioned E.J. Cooper there was the superintendent, and he had been the superintendent since the 30s. And the principal, Milo Milky, had also been the principal of the high school since the 1930s. And Milo Milky moved to the new high school and held that position until he retired in 1968. And that was 39 years in the Robbinsdale School District. And E.J. Cooper was the same way. And E.J. Cooper had come to Robbinsdale in about 1930 and taken the superintendent job, was still showing up at functions at the E.J. Cooper High School in the 1980s. We had a little rock band called the Jets that had a moment of fame and fortune in the 80s. And E.J. Cooper would show up at their concerts, and he would always show up in his letter jacket, and he was always a big proponent of Cooper High School. And we're going to forgive him, because it's always been rumored that he showed up at the school board meeting where they closed Robbinsdale High School. And with, you know, tears running down his face, he said, please don't close the school that's named after me. So they didn't. They closed Robbinsdale High School instead. Whether or not they should have closed Cooper or maybe Armstrong. I mean, Armstrong would have been the most expensive one to run. Just the heating and cooling costs on that place, the property value. But no, they closed Robbinsdale High School. But it wasn't until, you know, about 1982. So for many years there, starting the 1950s, that school building over on Toledo was the glory of the town. And all of our sports teams, you know, did so wonderfully, and they kept adding gymnasiums. It really was quite a blow to the town when we lost that. But the high school was such a big deal. The other thing that happens in the 1950s is Crystal Lake has, as you know, since the beginning of Robbinsdale history, we have done one terrible thing to Crystal Lake after another. We talked about the huge fuel oil leak from the Terrace Theater and how these 10,000 gallons of fuel oil had spilled into this swamp. And of course, that's adjacent to Crystal Lake. There was old Highway 52 was dividing the theater and the lake. So maybe a lot of that fuel oil didn't make it into the lake. But in about 1949, this great big dredging operation starts to take place. And they had changed the entire shape of the lake. They had brought great big truckloads of the dredge and piled it up on the south end of the lake. And that area then is set aside for parkland. The neighbors had originally wanted all sorts of other things done with that area. They had wanted it to be a little canal that would go into their backyard so that the houses that had just been built up at the top of the hill could get down to the canal and then go out to Crystal Lake on boats, maybe. But they filled the whole thing in, and they created some baseball diamonds, and they created a little playground, and then they needed to name the park, and they had a contest to name the park. And if your name was chosen, you got a free bicycle from the Coast to Coast hardware store. So it was, they solicited all the children in the town to name the park, and they ended up naming it Lakeview Terrace Park, which, you know, because you've got a view of the lake and behind you, you've got the Terrace Theater. So it's Lakeview Terrace Park. And that place becomes just a huge gathering spot. The Whiz Bang Days festivities are held down there. They used to bring in carnies right up until the 1990s. They brought in rides and carnies and set up beer tents. And Lakeview Terrace just became the spot where all the new citizens of the town were gathered up. So by the 1950s, our Goodwill Days parade has turned into Whiz Bang Days, and Whiz Bang Days becomes the big civic festival for the summer. In July of 1952, 20-year-old Joanne Melberg, who was the sweetheart of the Sigma Chi fraternity at the University of Minnesota, becomes Robbinsdale's Queen of the Lakes candidate. And then she's crowned the Aquatennial Queen in 1953. And Joanne grew up on Obbot, just on the east side of Crystal Lake. She was a member of the Delta sorority and was planning a career as an elementary school teacher, like all the best people in Robbinsdale were. Joanne told the Minneapolis Tribune that she was not engaged and didn't have any steady beaus. Crowns were nothing new to Joanne. The previous year, she had been Miss Sparkle of the Minneapolis Junior Chamber of Commerce, and she'd been Miss Robbinsdale, of course. We don't think of what a big deal it was to be the Aquatennial Queen, but whenever we put something on the Robbinsdale Historical Society website about who was the Aquatennial Queen or what was going on at the Aquatennial, all of these memories just come flooding at us. People are always telling us their memories, and they talk about Joanne Melberg. We had a program here at the Historical Society where we brought in somebody from the Hennepin County Historical Society who had written a book about the Aquatennial, and she talked about some of the things the Aquatennial Queens got to do, like fly down to Rio de Janeiro to represent Minneapolis at the carnival in Rio, or to go to Mardi Gras in New Orleans. They flew these people all around the world. They had luncheons. They put them up in the best hotels in downtown Minneapolis to celebrate, you know, their crowning. And it was just, it was a huge deal. Robbinsdale had a couple Aquatennial Queens. The Robbinsdale City Band marched every year in the Minneapolis Aquatennial. So we all kind of tried to get on board with the Aquatennial. And, of course, down there at Worth Lake, we had the Aqua Follies, and all the people in Robbinsdale would turn out for that. So in March of 1953, more than 2,000 residents are met at the Fire and Police Station Auditorium for the Robbinsdale Taxpayer Payers Association after valuations of their homes jumped from 29% to 35%. Theodore Christensen of 4228 Halifax presided. The association met for a few years to study the taxes and find out the effects of the increased evaluations. And of course, people still talk about this sort of thing now, but as the community grew and it just became more valuable, the homes became more valuable. And Robbinsdale had never been a place where a lot of money ever gathered. It's always, you know, there's, with the exception of the Robbins family dating all the way back to the 1890s and the possible exception of the Girling family or the Pearson family, who did okay selling nail guns, and Girling did okay with his various businesses. But there was just never that much money here. So the idea that your property value is going to jump and you're looking at your parents' house that was built in the 1920s and it doesn't have that sort of value, but your mid-century rambler, all of a sudden, that maybe you built with a bunch of your neighbors, its property taxes increased by 29 to 35%. You know, I'm surprised that they didn't burn down the city hall. Well, and the reason these property taxpayers met over at the police station auditorium is because it was decided in the mid-50s that the old village hall that sat on West Broadway, that was built originally as the Crystal Village Hall in 1890, needed to come down. Red Owl had come to town a few years earlier, and they had rented out a building and then built another building right next to the old village hall. The reason the village hall needed to go is because they needed a driveway into their parking lot. There were some other excuses made. At one point, the city proposed building a municipal liquor store on that spot, but it was just the Red Owl. If you were going to keep them happy and keep them in town, they needed the driveway to come off of West Broadway so people that were driving down West Broadway could pull in to their parking lot. So it was a kind of a blow to lose that old building for something as silly as that. The piece of property, though, is still just part of the city of Robbinsdale. It was donated by the Parker family. It always has to be used for civic use. It's still a driveway, so you can get from West Broadway between the hardware store and Marna's Cafe, so you can go into that parking lot where McDonald's is now. And we should mention the municipal liquor store story, because that was kind of a big deal. In the early 1950s, Robbinsdale's looking around at other suburbs that have municipal liquor. I think Richfield is one example. But a few cities around decided, why don't we make some money if we open up our own liquor stores, and we won't have to worry about what's going on at the liquor store, what's going on at the bar, what kind of trouble is being caused there, because it would all be owned by the city and run by the city, and we'll get the tax revenue for that, and that'll help us pay for all of our municipal services, our roads, our curbs, our parks. And so Robbinsdale jumps on this bandwagon, and they had 5 or 6 proposals to build a municipal liquor store in downtown Robbinsdale, and nobody liked it. Not only that, nobody really liked the idea of the city being in charge of liquor. In addition to being the only entity that could sell liquor, they wanted to be the only entity that would serve it in bars. They carved in some exceptions for the few 3-2 bars that were in town, said you guys can continue to sell 3-2, but the only place you'll be able to buy a drink is at the municipal liquor store. And of course, that later became the Muni, which was still here until the 1990s. The only place you could get yourself a drink was at our city-owned, government-owned bar, which was downtown. And the Muni got a reputation, I'll mention, for professional wrestlers, because we have tons of pro wrestlers. And starting in the 1950s, even late 1950s, early 60s, I'm told that you could find Larry the Axe Hennig sitting at the bar at the Muni. And many years later, there's lots of stories and pictures of his son hanging out. Kurt Hennig used to hang out at the Muni. Rick Rude would hang out at the Muni. There are Facebook pages devoted to the history of the municipal bar in Robbinsdale. I don't know who really misses it. Nana Rosa's was the last business I can remember being in that building, and I know they're not going to be there much longer. Not sure what's going to happen to them. But the building will probably still be standing, and it's our legendary municipal bar. So let's talk about the roads in the area. So coming out of North Minneapolis, West Broadway is heading up, and you've got this complicated intersection where West Broadway, Lowry Avenue out of North Minneapolis, Victor Memorial Drive continuing north, Oakdale heading off to the west, and York Avenue is coming in. And in 1945, they decided to build a great big roundabout there. The original pictures of the roundabout, you can see trolley tracks crossing it diagonally. But people had come to this intersection before they had the roundabout and not know what to do. I'm sure they came up to the intersection just like people do nowadays and saw the giant roundabout and said, what am I supposed to do? It wasn't called the roundabout. Everybody referred to it as the circle. And on the west side of the circle, where York Avenue and Oakdale came in, you had the hospital. You had this little thing called the Dairy Bar for a number of years, where you could come in and get a milkshake or an ice cream cone. That eventually became a dairy store. Then it became Circle Drug. Dr. Samuelson from Victory Hospital built a little clinic next to that. And then if you look to the east, you've got a brand new congregational church. Parkway United Church of Christ is built there. And you've got a Broster, and it's got a funny looking guy that looks a little bit like a chicken up on a sign, and Broasted Chicken Place, very popular. You have a little gas station there. And then if you, on the sort of northeast corner, you've got a little stand where sometimes they would actually, I wouldn't call it a farmer's market, but you'd have a vegetable stand there. On the northwest side, you've got St. Cyr's Greenhouses. Eventually, they build a great big water tower behind there. So as you come to the circle, you're either going to go north up Victor Memorial Drive. The trees are a lot bigger now than they were in the 1920s. So whenever we see old pictures of the drive and we see all those great big elms, and remember when they all came down in the 70s, it was a little sad, but the Victor Memorial Drive was just spectacular then. And West Broadway, as it continued, it became Highway 52, and Robbinsdale, as per its traditions, had planted all these beautiful trees along Highway 52, and then you come into Lakeview Terrace Park going that way. That's coming in from the south. On the west side of the town, Highway 100 has become, well, the way I kind of remember it, you still have stoplights on it. It's not a freeway all the way through. We're just going to imagine the lilac bushes are grown up now. They've had, 15, by 1960, 20 years of lilac bushes growing up and down there. You've got stoplights at 36. You've got another stopway light about halfway up until you get to Rockford Road at 42nd. And, of course, the junior high is along Highway 100. You can see the senior high, the middle school now along Highway 100. And as you curve and you start going toward Twin Lake, there's Grazier Park is there. At that time, the parks, the Grazier Park, Blazer Park, these Lilac Way parks were still places where people gathered up, had picnics, roasted weenies in the Beehive fireplace and some of the other fireplaces. And it was just a big family gathering spot. The highways were starting to get busier, but it was still felt like you were kind of out in the country when you went down those highways. And as you crossed West Broadway or Highway 52 at that point, you started heading toward Twin Lake. Highway 100 now crosses Twin Lake. And as you're heading east again, Twin Lake has been altered, just like Crystal Lake got dredged and filled in, and the shape of it changed. Twin Lake, they cut what was referred to at the time, and I don't think anybody calls it this anymore, was St. Cyr Bay, because the St. Cyr family owned some property on the east side of the lake, and they took a marshy area and a spot where this little creek ran off toward Ryan Lake, and they cut in a bay, a good-sized bay, and that, of course, increased the property values, and eventually they built more houses over there and a couple apartment buildings. And then our roads in Robbinsdale, West Broadway gets some new streetlights at some point, and this shows up in newspapers, and the city's very proud of it, and there's postcards that show these streetlights. And because downtown was still a pretty busy business district, all the merchants down there wanted to make it seem like a fun place, so they kept it well lit. So on November 24th, 1955, the Robbinsdale Post reported that a Laker coach accept the boys' state championship here. Westfall American Legion Post 251 of Robbinsdale is fortunate this year to have a busy man like Johnny Kundla accept the boys' state chairmanship. Robbinsdale High School chooses the most outstanding boy in the junior class, and Westfall American Legion, the Post sends him to the boys' state, and it's held every year at the University Farm School after the school has been dismissed for the summer vacation. Here, each boy is taught and shown the workings of the U.S. government. Johnny Kundla was happy to accept the appointment, even though his Lakers basketball team keeps him busy most of the year. Having been a club visitor on numerous occasions, he realizes what a wonderful program it is for these boys and future leaders of tomorrow. Johnny Kundla has been a member of the Westfall American Legion Post for years, and almost as long as he has been coach of the Minneapolis Lakers. So that was, our little taste of celebrity here in Robbinsdale, as we had the coach of the Lakers. We know he lived over there by Victor Memorial Drive. He sent his kids to the Robbinsdale High School. And I don't know that the NBA was quite the organization then that it is now. I think this guy lived in a pretty modest home, but everybody knew who he was. When you were the coach of the pro basketball team, you got paid attention to. And I think Westfall American Legion, which was always so busy, before the city ever put together its rec programs, the T-ball, the softball, the football that they had for a while, archery, they had all these programs with the Robbinsdale Park and Rec Board. But before they ever did that, the Westfall American Legion had a hockey team. They had their peewee hockey team, and they practiced over at Sanborn Park. They did ice skating over on Crystal Lake, and they had, even when I was a kid, they had these ice skating events where they passed out gold, silver, and bronze medals at the end of each event. And they had a gun that they fired off in the air, a firing gun that they'd used to start each race. So it was always really exciting. And they just continued to play such an important part in civic affairs, especially in the 1950s when so many of these veterans from World War II had come back to Robbinsdale. And one of the things they left us are these beautiful photos from 1949, where they're building their American Legion Hall over there across the street from the Terrace Theater. They're in this strange Technicolor, and they're blown up the size of sheets of paper. but all of the buildings are just guys standing in front of cinder block walls. And it's interesting to look at the trucks in the background. You can see a couple of these old trucks. And it's kind of interesting that none of these guys are wearing blue jeans. They don't always have ties on, but everybody's got a shirt with a collar, generally a white shirt with a collar, and they got what look like khakis on. They don't look like they're dressed for construction. Sometimes there'll be a bandana tied around one of their necks, or there'll be a hat that you just don't see these days very often. It has always just burned me that they never took any pictures of Crystal Lake out beyond the American Legion Hall, or across the street to where there was this little grocery store, or even of the terrace. It's all of the pictures that from the American Legion are of their building that they built. And that building was only torn down a couple of years ago, and it really was the gathering place of the community. Big events, ballrooms, weddings, they had everything there. And to look at these pictures, you wonder, did they hire an architect? They certainly didn't hire a construction firm, because these guys are just the members of the American Legion. They're building this cinder block building. Later on, Schmidt Music takes up part of the building on the side facing France Avenue, and they have a great big side that faces Crystal Lake, and they fill that in with some giant plate glass windows so they get a better view of the lake as you get into the 60s. The other little business that I remember being in the American Legion building is the Robbinsdale Municipal Liquor Store. Kind of had another, they had their big location was in Robbins Center, and then they had a smaller location that was down there in the American Legion building. And I'm sure a couple other little businesses came and went, but the Legion always had a bar there. So in 1959, we got this sort of new municipal building where we had the fire trucks and the police station, and there were offices upstairs. This building today is the Hubbard Transit Center. It's amazing that this got saved at all and just didn't get bulldozed like anything else in Robbinsdale. It's not the most remarkable building built in 1949, but it had an auditorium in it. And when the auditorium wasn't being used for things like taxpayer meetings, it was used by teenagers, and everybody remembers it as the Teen Center in Robbinsdale. It's funny that fires always happened so close to the fire station, and crime always happened so close to the police station. And the reason I bring that up is the Teen Center became notorious because young men, maybe from North Minneapolis, maybe from some other suburbs, certainly they couldn't have been Robbinsdale's young men, but they would show up at the Teen Center and they would lure the girls that were coming out of the Teen Center and that were going back and forth to the dances at the Teen Center into their cars. And then they would drive to liquor stores and they would buy beer. And this became so scandalous that they closed down the Teen Center, and the mayor said they would never open the Teen Center again. And the principal at the high school said the Teen Center has become such a problem, and we have all these juvenile delinquents. We have young women passed out drunk. We've got to put an end to this. The morality, you know, so they, and this takes up editorial pages in the Star Tribune as people are writing letters back and forth. The PTA and various students from Robbinsdale just say, look, you guys are painting us all with this great big brush. We're not all delinquents. What usually happens at the Teen Center is we all get together, we put on a record, and we dance, and we have some cookies, and we have some juice and some other appropriate beverages here. And what you're talking about is just a few people that are spoiling it for everybody. And eventually the city and the school board and everybody relents, and the teens get to have their dance center. And it's just remembered really fondly by all the people that come into the Historical Society to this day. If you grew up in the 1950s, you were going to dances at the Teen Center. And I think they probably, you know, had some bumper pool and some other things for kids to do up there. But it was, you know, it's that story of, well, we got to give the kids something to do, otherwise they'll turn into juvenile delinquents. But then if we give them this Teen Center, then they're all going to get together and behave poorly. And so it went back and forth, and it was a great place to hang out. So in 1956, Father Nolan decides he needs to build a new church. The old Sacred Heart had sort of outlived its usefulness and was too small for the congregation. In the 1950s, they were building churches all over Robbinsdale, and Sacred Heart was not going to be left out. They needed a new facility. The place where he wanted to build the church was the home of the Robin Hotel, and that was owned by the McDonald family. And he bought them out, but he wanted to keep the hotel, so he moved it across the street. At the Historical Society, we came across this wonderful letter that was written by Julia McDonald, and it tells the story of her memories going all the way back to childhood and through the years that her and her husband owned the Robin Hotel.
And in this letter of memories written by Julia McDonald, Julia says, "I was born in 1899 in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota. My parents, Charles and Louisa Prestige, rented some land and a house from Earl Brown. We moved to Robbinsdale at 44th and Regent Avenue about 1903. It was a very small house. I had three sisters, Louise, Alice, and Clarissa. My grandparents, Henry Scott and Louisa, owned the house. They lived on the Rockford Road back of the school. The house was near Highway 100. He had land on both sides of Rockford Road. As soon as we were old enough, we used to weed onions, carrots, beets, etc., and help my grandfather turn the cucumber and melon vines while he cultivated them with a horse and cultivator. My grandfather, Thomas Prestige, used to come often from Rockford, Minnesota, in a horse and buggy with eggs and butter from Rockford. He had customers in Minneapolis. He would come down one day, deliver his things the next day, and then go back the third day. My sister Alice tried to ride my father's bicycle and fell off and broke her arm. My father went and got Dr. Kolk to come and set it. He wasn't licensed then, so he said my father could give him what he wanted to. My folks used to take us up to the depot some nights so we could watch the train pick up the mail from a post. They would grab the bag without stopping the train. My older sister and I started school on Regent Avenue. Ira Howard was my first teacher. She passed away that year. About 1908, we moved to 3827 Lee Avenue. We had four bedrooms. We thought it was wonderful. We had two lots, so my father had a garden. My father worked for Bill Bosert, making cement blocks across the railroad tracks. We used to go there a lot and watch him. There was no water, bathroom, or electric lights when we moved in. There was a pump outside the kitchen door, and we didn't have many neighbors when we moved in. My grandmother and grandfather Scott moved in with us about 1910. My grandfather passed away. My parents let my sister Louise and I go to the funeral. The service was at our house. We went to the cemetery in a carriage called a hack. It was a cold day, but we enjoyed the ride. About 1908, my brother was born. There were four of us girls, and we sure spoiled Henry. There wasn't many cars. Mr. Morse got a car, and he used to come and take us for a ride. He had a crank on it. In 1912, my mother and father went to Rockford. His father was real sick. My father got real sick with typhoid fever while there. His father died, but he wasn't able to go to the funeral. We stayed home alone. Our neighbor, Mrs. Richard, cooked a lunch for us at noon as we came home at noon for lunch. She made some potato pancakes we sure enjoyed. When my father was able to come home, Mr. Priest, school principal, offered to go to Rockford and bring him home in his car. There wasn't many cars then. My father was sick at home a long time. Robbinsdale people were so good to us. I graduated from the 8th grade in 1913 and started North High in the fall. We took the streetcar down in the morning and walked home at night. In the following spring, I quit school and got a job at Power's store in Minneapolis in the soda fountain. I was there about 6 months when Alan McDonald offered me a job in the grocery store that he and J.W. Russ owned on the corner of West Broadway and 42nd Avenue. He offered me more money than I was getting at Powers. I didn't have to pay streetcar fare, and I could go home for lunch, so I changed jobs. Harriet Russ, Herbert Clausen, Alan McDonald, and J.W. Russ worked at the store. Herbert Clausen, or Hub, would drive a horse and wagon and take orders around Robbinsdale one day. We put them up, and he would deliver them the next day. In 1918, I went to Minnesota Business College, and then I got a job at the Federal Reserve Bank. June 22, 1921, I married Alan McDonald. His wife, Cora Russ, had passed away, and we lived in his house on 38th and Noble. He had a son, Sidney, who lived with us. About 1922, he sold his share of the store to Frank Gefuhrer and got a job at Ralston Purina Company. Business wasn't so good for a while, and he was laid off. My brother had a small restaurant on 41st Avenue, back of the drugstore, and he bought that. My father was real ill, so we moved him back home on Lee Avenue so I could help take care of him. In 1932, he passed away. We heard the Elwood Hotel was for sale. Mrs. Fox had moved out. We called Mr. Lamb, the owner, and asked if we could rent or buy it. He said he would call us, and in a few days he said we could rent it for a few months, and if we got along okay, he would use the money we would pay for rent as a down payment. Mrs. Rogers and Mrs. Malbin were eating a lot in the restaurant, and we told them we were thinking about moving into the hotel. They said they would each rent a room and would help us get started. We moved into the hotel the 1st of September 1932 and ran the hotel for 25 years. We had to buy furniture, bedding, etc. for the rooms. We got some furniture from Mrs. Fox and bought more as we rented the rooms. It was slow in starting, but wasn't long before we had most of the rooms rented. We got some railroad men, some older people, and business people. We had 10 rooms upstairs and 5 bedrooms on main floor, plus the kitchen, dining room, living room, and a room for the piano and TV. We had 4 children, James, Alice, Charles, and Alan Jr. My mother moved in with us also, and she was a lot of help. At first, we just rented rooms, but soon we sold the restaurant to Victor and Mrs. Hansen, who kept the restaurant for a long time. Then we served meals in the hotel, and Alan was called back to Ralston Purina Company. It was a lot of hard work. The ladies were good to help us, and some neighbors, Mrs. Clausen and Mrs. Getz, used to come to visit, and they always helped us when they were there. At first, there was people coming to see Dr. Culp, so we tried to keep a couple extra rooms for people stopping overnight. We always had boys from school. My sons brought boys home, and Mr. Woodward used to bring boys over for meals and pay for them. Vern Gagne, the wrestler, and Dick Ekstrand were with us a long time. So many things happened I will never forget. I was a banker for a lot of the men. After they paid for board and room, they gave me money to keep. It was always gone before the next payday. One man came in one night about 11 o'clock and came to our bedroom door and knocked. He said, "Julia, I was shot." My husband and I got up, and he was shot in the shoulder as he came down Hubbard Avenue. We called the police, and they came and took him to the hospital. My cousin's little boy came over one night with his folks. When he came in the back hall, he said, "I didn't know teeth grew with apples." Mac used to often take his lower teeth out and put them in his shirt pocket. He picked up some apples at Dr. Rawson's, and I guess the teeth fell in the apple basket. He had been looking all over for them. Some of the roomers used to play cards and games in the living room at night. We served the lunch and dinner at night family style in the dining room. Breakfast we served in the kitchen. The men were always in a hurry to leave. We reset a place as soon as they finished. I put up a lot of lunches for the men. When my 2 older sons wanted extra money, they would go upstairs and tell some of the boarders they needed their shoes shined. They knew where to go. They made a kit, box with a brush, cloth, and shoe polish. They made quite a lot of money. We had 2 families come from Holland. The 2 men came first. Their uncle brought them to the hotel. He got employment for them at a nursery. I didn't have a room, so I got a place for them to sleep across the street, and they got their meals with us. About a year later, their families came. One family stayed with us, and one family stayed where the men had stayed until they bought a house and their furniture came from Holland. It was hard for them as they couldn't talk much English. They got along real well. They went to school. Their children were small and enjoyed American food. In 1956, Father Nolan came over and asked us if we would sell the hotel to the church. They wanted to move the building and build a new church on the corner. He asked us to think about it and call him. When we decided we would sell, we called him. We had asked 2 different real estate men what it was worth, so we told him. He was real happy about it. He said they couldn't get started on it right away, so we could stay in there until June 1st, 1957. We notified our roomers, so they got other rooms. We had bought a house from Mrs. McLean at 4400 Lake Drive when she went in a rest home. We moved in there June 1st. Mr. McDonald passed away on November 26th, 1962, but I am still there. Thanks for listening. I'm Crystal Boyd. Robbinsdale Revisited is brought to you by the Robbinsdale Historical Society. Our little history museum is located at 4915 42nd Avenue North in the heart of Robbinsdale. We're open Fridays and Saturdays from 10 to 3. You can also visit us online at robbinsdale.org. You found this episode, so you know where to find the next one. Bicycle into the city every Saturday to see our friends. In bus back home, sitting hand in hand. When the evening ends, when the and
Our theme music is provided by Gabe Barnett and The Rounders.